Welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, September 22nd, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, it is for people who can handle the truth. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my books, The Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book 2 and 3. It is a work in progress. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. All of the more recent audio files of my programs are at that site, and I recently set up a Twitter account, and that is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. If you have questions during this program, please call 646-787-1915. Again, 646-787-1915. We will be taking comments and questions from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chatango.com, and we do invite you to participate in the chat room. My guest today, and someone that I just dearly love, and we haven't spoken for quite some time, is Michael Walsh. He is the author of The Triumph of Reason, The Thinking Man's Guide to Adolf Hitler, a compilation of Adolf Hitler's statements, and Witness to History, which is available on Kindle at Amazon, and Behind Enemy Lines, The Reich Had Its Heroes, too. His website, and he also has a Facebook page, but the website is Walsh Poems, and the name is spelled W-A-L-S-H, walshpoems.com. Michael, hello.
How are you? It's lovely to see your face on my screen again. You look so American, so petite and well turned up.
Well, I am American, yes. Well, it's always wonderful to see you. Always, even if you had bad news and we talk about things that are very serious, you're always uplifting. It just seems to emanate because there's always a flicker of hope that, hey, you know, things are bad. Things have been bad, but I just feel hopeful. Okay.
I think we have the fuel in our tank, Deanna, is optimism. You know, hope springs eternal in the human breast. And, you know, that really sums our outlook on life, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I always feel pretty upbeat. Once in a while, I have a guest on that's kind of into fear mongering. I think it's okay to talk about things that are going to happen so we can get prepared. But boy, sometimes, you know, you don't want to be afraid, because that's exactly what the government would like to put into us. They want us to be very, very afraid, right?
I'm glad you said that, and I've got a very good example, if we remember to cover this topic a little bit later. But all of the scaremongering is coming from the establishment, the elite, in both Europe and in the United States. And in actual fact, the majority of the world population is very, very upbeat about the changes that lie ahead.
That's good. That is very good. Yes.
Yeah, I could give you an example of this. As you know, I cover Europe, you know, Russia and Eastern Europe, Western Europe. I have a great many friends throughout the world, America too included, of course. But I was having a conversation with a very, very good friend of mine who's very, very close to her 90th birthday. She's Latvian. And as you can imagine, she has seen things in her life that we don't really want to talk about on radio. She was caught up when the Soviet army invaded Europe in 1945.
Wow.
And there was a lot of pieces to pick up, and they were very, very messy. And she was at the front lines and witnessed the most appalling horrors. But Lilia is a wonderful lady, wonderful spirits. But because they experienced the Soviet invasion for so many years, 40 years. I always say, for us, the war ended in 1945. For the Eastern Europeans, their war carried on until 1990. That's right. They had 45 years, Diana, of Soviet occupation, and they were treated as Kaffirs were in South Africa. They were second-class citizens, and they suffered greatly, deportations and everything. And the point I'm making is she was frightened out of her wits because the media keeps on telling her that the Putin's Russia is about to invade the Baltic states. They are not. I will guarantee they're not. All they have to do, if they want to bring pressure on, is turn the taps on the gas, because the Baltic states are 100% dependent upon Russian power sources. So they don't have to put a tank. But the point I'm making, Diana, is she was frightened out of her wits that she was going to come out of her home and she was going to find the Red Army there again. So what is happening, Diana, is America foreign policy and Europe, backed up NATO, have put the fear of God under these people about a Soviet invasion. They still keep calling them Soviets, although they left that 25 years ago. And the reason that they're doing it is they are frightening the Baltic people, the Latvians, the Estonians, the Poles, and the Lithuanians. They're frightening them so much that they will be foolish enough to accept a NATO presence on their soil.
Oh.
And that's the reason why they're frightening the life out of these poor dears.
Oh,
it's the only reason. If it wasn't for that, NATO is not approved. In Germany, it's getting its big thumbs down. There are massive demonstrations against NATO throughout Europe. And they're losing their hold, Diana.
That is what I love about the Europeans, that they, many of them, are so awake to things that are going on, and they are not afraid to go out in the streets and yell. They really do have a wonderful spirit. Now, people here in this country, they just are reticent. They believe everything that they hear on the news, and they simply are not willing to be courageous and go out and let people know. And the few demonstrations that we do have are not covered by the news at all. And so, well, other people aren't going to take the initiative and go out and demonstrate.
No, CBS and NBC and the rest of the news, you know, because I'm telling you, you know, what you already know, that in the United States, people are under the illusion that there are thousands of independent newspapers, magazines, radio and television stations. In actual fact, I think that the combined six corporations own 95% of them.
Exactly.
Very similar. It's very similar. So they're not getting any independent news. There was more independent news, no doubt, in the Soviet Union than there is in the United States today. Absolutely everything is in control. And over here in Europe, as I say, these major broadcasters in the United States, they're treated with absolute contempt. Everybody goes to Russia Today. And And they're quite shocked. The Americans are quite shocked when they look into the other side. And apparently, one of the Facebook pages that supports Russia has got more American supporters, likes, than Russian ones.
My goodness. That tells you a lot. That really tells you a lot. And I have friends that appear on Russia Today. And yeah, well, the news has been really censored in this country. It began to be censored even before they passed the Radio Act of 1927. But the Radio Act of 1927 started this censorship, and it was pretty much completed under the Reagan administration. They collapsed the fair and balanced doctrine, and so it's all controlled, it's all corporate, and it all depends on what the corporations want us to hear, want us to believe, and but people don't understand. They think that they still have this, they think that they're getting the news, and it's totally propaganda. All of it.
Yes, of course it is. As I've said before, I only have to listen. People say that they've got opinions. Deanna, they don't have opinions at all. What they do have is listen to them. You can say, oh, you've been listening to NBC. You've been listening to CBS. You know, you can tell that they've been listening to mainstream media because it's not their opinion. What they are doing is they are reflecting the opinions that are put into their heads by these major corporations.
Sure.
So people are not independent. They like to think that they're independent. They like to think that they created these ideas themselves. They didn't. It's like you saying, Michael is a wonderful author, and then quoting the book. Now, you're quoting a book, you're not quoting me. You see what I mean?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we are very optimistic here in Europe, and what you are not hearing about is there are massive demonstrations through all or most of the 28 nations that make up the European Union, and some of them are more than a million people at them, could you imagine? And these are quite regular occurrences. So, you know, we're approaching seismic changing times.
That is fabulous, yes. I, in fact, if I were to leave the country, and I've thought about leaving the country and going elsewhere, and I see change in Europe, and I think that would be a good thing to do. I probably won't. I've always felt like people should bloom where they're planted, but sometimes that's hard to do.
Yeah, I was talking with a very, very good friend of mine who we emerged as not so good friends because he's very much a lover of her. He's an Englishman, Welshman, and he adores America. He did at the time anyway. We're talking 2 years ago now. And we got into a pretty heated debate over our restaurant bill. I know that we shouldn't, but we did. And I predicted that the United States and Europe would collapse by 2020, which of course is 5 or 6 years off. And he was incandescent with such stupidity. And now, even in the 18 months that have passed since that restaurant meal, many of my prophecies are showing clear indication that it is happening, and it is happening much more quickly than I anticipated.
Indeed. Now the European Union, the whole when they put that all together, has that been a good thing or a bad thing? I know they have a common currency, which I think is not good. I hate to see monopolization of any kind. I like independent states, independent countries. But so how do you see the European Union?
It's like anything else, there are some people who say, yes, the Soviet Union did have its good points. And would you believe that there was an opinion poll in Eastern Europe and Russia not so long ago, and 45%, that's nearly half, of course, regretted the collapse of the Soviet Union, that life was much more stable. My wife, Nadia, was a school teacher in Ukraine, and you know, everything was taken care of from womb to tomb. She had a wonderful education, went to university, perhaps no expectations of being rich, but wonderfully rich in their culture, and a job for life with a pension and absolutely everything else. And when the Soviet Union collapsed and took Eastern Europe with it, then all the money disappeared, all of the pensions, all of the values of their assets, absolutely everything went. So where did the money go, Deanna? Where did the money go in Libya? Where did the money go in Iraq? It was all siphoned out by Wall Street and Israel.
Indeed, yes. And we hear this, all the time here in this country, that they are going to go after people's pensions, that they're going to go after people's bank accounts.
Yes, yes.
And I fear that that is exactly what is going to happen. So what would you recommend that people do with their assets, their They're supposed to, and really it's paper. I mean, if you collapse a dollar, completely collapse a dollar, and that's what you have in your as your assets, then, you know, they don't have to go in and actually seize them. They just collapse them to nothing, and there they go. Goodbye.
Yep. I have got the blueprint, Deanne, and I can't remember precisely here, but of course it will come up on Google. You know, when the Argentine collapsed, I think it was about 1999, 15 years ago, the year 2000. And if you Google up, you know, what happens during a collapse and look at Argentina, you know, people are in for a big, big shock, because this is the time when they go to the bank and they go to the cash point. And it won't kick any money out. It's closed. They go and knock on the door. They push the door of the bank open. It won't open. They're all closed. Their money is gone. It happened in Cyprus a couple of years ago. All of the people went to the bank, as usual, to get the money out that they needed to fill up the petrol, fill up the gas for the car, do their shopping. It was all closed. The money has gone. It has disappeared. The banks tell you what you're going to get, when you're going to get it, if you're lucky. This happened in Argentina, and of course the peso, I think it was devalued. And that's when you need, you know, $500 to buy the produce in the market, in the supermarket, that last week, you know, 200 euros would buy. So this is a complete and absolute collapse, and you're seeing it happen now in Ukraine. Is the prices are soaring, the jobs are drying up, there is no work to be had. I think in the last month alone, the inflation has taken care of 14% of it. The prices for the utilities, such as the gas and electricity and water, have actually doubled. And this is in a country where people beforehand could hardly scratch a living. So if they were struggling before, how on earth are they getting by when the prices are double what they were just a few weeks ago?
Wow.
It's shocking. And it will come to the United States. You know, I've got somewhere on this little box of tricks here, you know, the scale of the debt owed by, and it's soaring at about $440 billion a day. And, you know, the United States is heading for a big, big crash. And, of course, countries are pulling out of the petrodollar, which is, you know, the underlying fabric of the American economy. And as fast as it goes, and it won't happen overnight, but it will happen over the next 24 months, the American dollar will be finished. And that's when you will get economic collapse.
Right. And that that means credit unions, wherever you have the money, because if they devalue the money if they devalue all the money, it doesn't matter whether you have it under your mattress, whether you have it in a credit union, whether you have it in a bank, whether you have it wherever you have it, it's not going to be worth a darn.
No, invest in land and grow your own, because if you can grow your own produce, you can sell your excess. I remember as a young boy in Wales, which is very, very rural, most of what we ate was grown in our own garden, which was not a great size garden, but we did have a surplus and there was a family of seven. So you can grow your own and cut your bills. So this is where people will be going. They won't be going to the supermarket. If they don't go to their own garden, they will be going to their neighbours and they will be buying excess, and that's what they will be paying for. When collapse happens in other countries, then everybody to survive starts bartering. So if you've got an electrical problem at home, then fine. I will come round and fix it, but you've got hens that lay eggs, so you'll pay me in eggs, and this is the way it will go.
Right. Well, that's what Germany did after World War One. They didn't have any gold. They didn't have anything. All they had was things that they could barter, and they started doing it in a large scale with other countries. So that's what people have to do on a smaller scale, is have some something that they can offer to somebody else that needs it, and in return get something from that person. And
yeah, I believe in the Great Recession in the United States. I'm reading somewhere in a very good book, being written very well, and they said that the people in the countryside suffered far less than did the people in the cities, because they could grow their own, they could barter their own produce. And you know, Europe used to be like that at the turn of the last century. Because again, as I said before, Diana, most of us, we either shot, caught, or grew our own food.
Right. And so you need to know not only how to grow it, but how to preserve it after you've grown it, because the growing season is, well, depending on where you live, can be relatively short. So people need to gain those skills of canning and drying and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a friend in West Canada, and she is very, very good at bottling and canning all of her own food that they grow. So they will be self-sufficient. Also, we're very fortunate in respect of much of what we can purchase in our supermarkets will last for any number of years. So the can of peas, for instance, that may cost you 20 cents this week, could cost a dollar in this time in 1 year. So it would be better to stock up with the non-perishable foods rather than keep the money in the bank.
Right, right. And in some areas in this country, they've actually outlawed people from having gardens. Is that just
You're pulling my leg.
No, I'm serious. Some people have actually had SWAT teams come in and destroy their gardens and say, you cannot do it. It's against the law. It is against some sort of statute here in this city or this area. Yeah, that happens.
Well, there's got to be a method in their madness, isn't it? And they don't want people to be self-sufficient. They want people to be dependent upon the state.
Of course. And that has always been the case. Well, not always been the case with regard to gardens, but certainly in the last 20 years, they have really promoted dependence on the state for just so many things. So many things. They have made
Europe now is that America is the land of the free, but some restrictions may apply.
Yeah. How true. That is so true. Where before, when I grew up, we just always, my aunt and my uncle, all of my relatives. I grew up out west. All of my relatives were into hunting during hunting season and fishing and having their own chickens and their own garden. And that was just the way that we lived. And that was what we considered normal. My dad always had a garden. Always. I mean, there was just never a time when he didn't have a garden. And that was just the way it was. And now, as I look at my neighbors, there's large backyards in some of the areas here where I live. I don't see anybody gardening. There's a few people who do, and maybe there might be a community garden. But it used to be that everybody had a backyard garden. I I don't know. Maybe I was just not knowing. I was just looking at what I wanted to see, but I thought everybody used to garden, but apparently not.
Yeah, in Britain they used to have during the war, because of course it was impossible for Britain with its population on such a small island to be self-sufficient. So when the Germans, bless them, were sinking all of the convoys heading towards Britain with the food and all the rest of it, people were encouraged to rent out allotments, and these were publicly owned growing gardens. So people were, many people, certainly of my generation, had their own allotment in which they grew everything. And people were familiar with the growing process. And for that reason alone, one of many reasons, but Britain did survive due to the allotment system. We don't pay enough attention to that. When I'm in Eastern Europe, the Baltic states, There really is very, very little need for shops, except for perhaps some meats and things like that. But most people have got massive gardens. The gardens are four times the size of their home because land is at a premium there. Latvia, they call the Canada of Europe. It's the size of Holland and Belgium combined, and yet it only has a population of slightly less than 2 million, which is probably less than the population of Chicago. So there is plenty of land to be had. It's very, very cheap, and people just prefer to grow their own and barter their food and other needs with other neighbours. And there is a surplus. About this time of the year, as you're walking down the roads of these Baltic states, outside of most of the homes, there are boxes filled with apples and plums and pears and other growing produce. It's excess. They don't have a use for us. If we don't pick it up and put it in our shopping bag, free of charge, then it will go in the bin. And that's the kind of economy that we really do need.
Yes, yes. I always had a big garden. I don't now, but I always had a big garden. And the only thing that I needed to purchase, literally, were paper products and soap, and because I always got my raw milk from the dairy down the road, and I grew everything. I canned all summer. I mean, it was hard work. It's hard work, okay, but it's well worth it. And there's such a feeling of satisfaction to be able to see 36 jars of green beans or tomatoes or chicken. And yes, I did can chicken. I've canned just about everything you can think of. And there is such a wonderful feeling of satisfaction knowing that you can do this, that you can take care of yourself. And there's and people need to know how to repair their clothes. I see younger people who do not have a clue on how to repair their clothes. They might be able to sew on a button if they could find a needle. But I grew up knowing how to do these things. And I just can't imagine that there are people who, don't even know how to cook, or just the things that you need to know how to do. It's amazing. Now,
there are great changes about, and I would suggest to, in answer to your question before, what are people going to do in anticipation of collapse, which will come, I've got no doubts about it, and that is to start learning the ropes now. Now, you've covered a very important subject, clothes. I think I was 11 or 12 years old before I actually wore anything that nobody had worn before. Everything before then was second hand. I had an older brother, and when he got too big for his jacket or his shoes or whatever, then they were passed down to me. But when you think about it, it was a wonderful way of recycling. You know, now the ladies go in and buy a dress, and they'll buy a dress just for one night out, and then the dress won't be used again. So all this is going to change. And as I say, rather than have money in any institution at all, it will be worthless one day, is go and put it in the things that one needs for you and your family and your friends to survive, or that you can sell after the collapse and buy the non-perishable foods that will be good. You know, not so much beer and things like that. People will be too distracted for that sort of thing. But, you know, certainly the food that we need to survive. You know,
right.
The vegetable, the canned stuff.
Right. And the other thing that people need to have, I think, of course, is garden implements. I mean, okay, so you have a bunch of seeds, or maybe you have a bunch of food or something like that. People need to have the tools to dig up their grass, to get rid of the grass, and plant something that you can actually use. And you need to have the, for instance, what are you going to cook on if there's no if there's no utility company that's delivering gas to your house, or you know, if you have a gas stove or an electric stove, what do you do if those things are not available? How do you cook food? People need to know how to dry food. People need to learn this stuff.
Yeah, they need to, I'm going back and giving my age away, you know, but everything was cooked on the fire, or there were paraffin heaters, but there was no gas, there was no electricity in this very remote place in Wales. And, you know, Diana, it was one of the most happiest periods of my life. We had an orchard and everything else, and I would say my stepfather, if he wanted duck for the dinner, then he went down to the river and he strangled them on water. The gamekeeper brought the rabbits back, and you know, I hated the sound of my stepfather snapping the legs off them. You know, they were dead obvious.
Yeah.
But it still caused me to cringe, and then skinning them. But you know, these are the skills to start learning now, and it's a wonderful. As you know, in the 1980s, I had a gun shop, which was in a very rural area of Wales. So the most of my customers coming and going used guns and knives professionally, as they do in Canada and many parts of the United States. And they were the responsible kind. I met youngsters 8 or 9 years old who showed wonderful responsibility and ability to use a gun as a tool to keep the rats down and to bring some game home, not only for the family, but to feed the dogs and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And it was a pleasure. It was an absolute pleasure to work in this community in which a gun was an essential tool. And it was never, ever abused. In these communities, some of them are in the United States, many of them are in Europe, where buying, purchasing a gun or belonging to a gun club is as easy as going to a local nightclub. There is no gun crime of any, you know, you get your obvious aberrations, as in Norway. But by and large, in places like Sweden and the Baltic states, I couldn't believe it on the first occasion that I was living in a small city in Latvia. And when I went to bed that night, I could hear this gunfire. I said, what the heck is that? I could hear gunfire. It was people hunting. So it was quite funny. And when I used to go to Liverpool, which of course, like Chicago, one port city, you know, these people had never seen a gunfire apart from on the movies. And I lived in rural Wales, and they used to say to me, I used to say to them, I said, oh, I wake up every morning, you know, to the sound of gunfire.
And they were horrified.
It was the local farmer out hunting.
Yes, hunting was, I went hunting with my dad. I went fishing with my dad. I went fishing with my aunt and uncle and hunted. And nobody ever said, don't touch the gun. I mean, it just wasn't a big deal. We just knew, okay, that this instrument is dangerous if you handle it wrong. I mean, it was just the way life was.
So is a knife in your kitchen drawer.
Exactly.
So is the gas that you've got in your cooker. That's dangerous at all. And you don't stick your finger in the electricity socket, do you?
Of course not. Of course not.
You don't look down the barrel of a gun and pull the trigger to see if it works.
Yes.
Maybe we're a bit more responsible then, you know, but you know, a little less brainwashed by the mainstream media.
Sure, sure. Yes, and it is amazing. I'm reading some of the comments in the chat room that just a few minutes ago somebody posted something that they actually know how to sew on a button, and that their daughter-in-law or somebody was quite amazed that this person knew how to sew on a button. And really, I mean, when buttons fall off, some people just donate the clothes to the Salvation Army or something. And I think, my gosh, My goodness.
Yeah,
It's just.
my 30-year-old son, who's in a profession, he's a professional man, he's not stupid. And he said, I never realized how sprouts grew.
Oh my gosh. Okay, you bring up a very good point too. About, and I, somebody on yesterday's program, I have a program on RBN for 3 hours every Sunday. And somebody was, the guest was talking about how easy it is to sprout seeds. Now, everything sprouts. I mean, if you have wheat, if you store wheat, or if you store any kind of grain, lentils, beans, any of that stuff, it sprouts. And you need to know how to get it to sprout. And you can do it in glass jars. You can do it in they have regular sprouters that you can purchase. People need to know how to do things during the winter months. If you live in, I live in the Chicago suburbs. Nothing is going to grow in my backyard in the middle of winter. But if you want fresh greens, you can sprout them in your house, and it's quite easy to do.
I was surprised at how easy it was. My stepfather, to cut a long story short, he had an interesting history in your part of the world. Where is Sing Sing, Deanna? Where's a prison, Sing Sing, in the United States?
Yes. Is
You've
it
heard of
in
Sing
New
Sing? It's
York?
not a
Yes.
Chicago prison, is it?
No. No, I believe it's in New York.
Okay, this father-in-law of mine, who must have been born about, I should imagine, his father, in about 1910, stepfather, I should say. He lived and worked off the land in Canada and your part of the world. And he was a ruthless guy, but by God, if you needed to be out in the wild, he was the man to be. He knew how to live there. He had done it all in Canada and your part of the world. And an interesting story was in his background, because at one stage of his very young life at the time in Chicago before the war, he had taken part in a gun raid on a gas station in Chicago, and it had all gone badly wrong. And a 17-year-old youngster who was serving at the gas station was shot down. And he was caught, my stepfather, long before I knew him, of course. And he was sentenced to manslaughter. But the American law at the time, apparently, was that if you injured somebody and they died within less than 6 months, it was murder. If they lasted longer than 6 months, then it was manslaughter if they died. And the young man hung on to his life until a day after the 6 months had expired.
Wow.
So this Joe Rockwell had got 10 years in a Chicago prison. Not sure whether they served the entire term, but he ended up marrying, not marrying my mother, living with my mother, and he could live off the land. And he was a cruel man. He was an interesting man, but it was sort of being living with Jack London. There's my American hero out of the bag, Jack London. He was a terrific hero of mine. John
Sure.
Barleycorn and all the rest of it. What a guy.
Yes. Yeah, I looked Sing Sing up, and it is in New York.
Oh, it's in New York, is it?
Yeah.
Well, it was one of the notorious prisons, and I'm sure that you've got a few of them. As a matter of fact, apparently I hear now that you've got a lot more prisoners in the jails now. And we're calling the American prison system the Washington's gulag.
Yes, there are more people per capita in prison in America than just about any other place, and I think it's because of the corrupt. Well, it is because of the corrupt justice system, but because they have been privatized, and the judges and the prisons, the corporate prisons, well, they make money. And what you have is slavery, because they produce certain things in these prisons and pay the manufacturers 10 cents an hour or whatever, and the judges get so much money person that they send off to prison. And further, they have criminalized so many nonviolent kinds of activities that you could get 15 years for just a minor infraction.
Yeah,
but you could murder somebody and get 7.
Yeah. Now, you tell me, you're wonderful listeners, or you yourself, in what way is this any different from the indentured slaves that were sent from Europe in the 18th and the 19th centuries? These were people who, in England, Ireland, were committed the smallest of crimes, and they were sentenced to, say, perhaps 10 or 15 or 20 or life as an indentured slave, which was just a fancy way of saying a slave. And they did exactly that. They were deported and transported to Australia, the United States, to Canada, to South America, and they served time working for institutions.
Sure.
Plantations. And, you know, the profits were going straight into the boss's pocket. Now, in what way is the American system different now that it's being privatized from the period of the indentured slaves being sent over there? It hasn't changed.
Exactly. It's the same, except now you have so many of the corporations that own that it's become corporatized. You're not just working for one master, you're working for one corporation, and that corporation does not have just a couple of people working for them. They have a whole prison working for them.
Absolutely. You know, things cannot continue as they are. They can't in the United States, and they certainly can't in the European Union. You mentioned the European Union before. You know, it's good points and it's bad points. There are minor points. Okay, when we go from Spain to Germany, from Germany to the Baltic states or Holland, we use the same money. We don't have to change it. But let's face it, changing money is not the end of the world. But it was Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Soviet Secretary of State, the last president of the Soviet Union. And he said, quite rightly, why is the European Union trying to copy so closely the Soviet Union, which has collapsed? Now, if I go out into the streets of Chicago or Los Angeles or New York, and I say, what's the name of your president? They say, Barack Obama. They won't even come out. They'll know it. You go onto the streets of Spain or Germany or Belgium and say, you've got two presidents. Tell me their names. They would look at you with blank bewilderment. They don't know. They're both unelected. They virtually run the 28 nations. They have what the Soviets used to call commissars. They call them missionaries. And there's 27 of those that make up the government of the European Union, and not one of them is elected. The European Union does not have a foreign policy. It does not have a common defense policy. Its banks are run by Goldman Sachs. Europe is not independent. It's a colony of Washington and Wall Street. And this is why America, if it goes, it will drag Europe with it, or rather Western Europe. And we will scatter into the arms of Putin's Russia, I'm afraid.
Wow.
This is the way it will go. And when we have talked before, Rihanna, I said that history repeats itself, but in your case, it will be in reverse. And if there is an economic collapse of the United States, then people are going to leave the United States, especially the European peoples. They're going to leave the United States in the same droves as their grandparents and their great-grandparents once emigrated to the United States.
Exactly.
And I think, yeah, they will be coming back. They will be coming back to their homelands in Europe.
We talked earlier about famine being a way of, getting rid of people. And you mentioned Ukraine. And I thought about the situation in 1845 through 1848 in Ireland, where they actually produced enough food to feed 18 million people. They had about 9 million people at the time, and they produced enough food for 18 million. But the problem was that they were exporting it all. They didn't have, and it wasn't the Irish government, because the Irish government had given up their autocracy to Britain. And so the British were exporting all of this food from Ireland, and that is why you had the Irish famine. It wasn't that the Irish were just lazy and didn't produce enough to feed themselves, but they had slave masters over them in the form of the English government, which was exporting all their food.
Precisely. It was a blueprint for what happened, and I say, and you know as well as I do, Diana, how I detest Joe Stalin. But there is very little that Joe Stalin did in the Soviet Union that the British hadn't done before. The British had their gulags too, in which a far higher number of people died in the concentration camps of South Africa, the Boers, Ireland, and people are quite surprised when I tell them this, is that you talked about Ireland at the time being able to feed 16 or 18 million people. Ireland at the time had a population of over 4 million, which is considerable for the rural country at the time. And 40% of the Irish population just disappeared. They either died through starvation, they were deported, they emigrated, they were transferred. 40%, could you imagine any nation at all having its population reduced by nearly half due to entirely artificial reasons? That famine in Ireland was artificial, just as the Ukrainian was in 1927.
Exactly.
When 7 million people died. And that was so Stalin could sell their harvests to raise the money to repay Wall Street for having funded the Bolshevik Revolution.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, this is the reality, and people don't want to hear the reality. They prefer their illusions, but the reality is going to slap them in the face pretty soon. So it's best that they get on the learning curve now, and that is what happened. And Ukraine is the biggest, leaving aside Russia, because half of it is in Asia, leaving aside Russia, Ukraine is the biggest country in Europe, okay? It is going bankrupt. It is going down the pan very, very quickly. But the last time I checked, its economy was the 72nd worst in the world. Now, Ukraine used to be called, before the First World War, the breadbasket of Europe.
Yes.
Its prairies were so great. It was so much like Canada, that whatever they grew, there was an abundance of them. And they were feeding Europe. The wheat wasn't coming from the United States or Canada at the time. In Europe, most of it was coming from Ukraine. This was a country that had everything that God could bestow upon a wonderful nation, the biggest. Now, what has happened since February this year? The most wonderful country in Europe with the greatest potential has been brought down to absolute penury, destruction by the European Union and the United States. If they will do that to the Ukraine, then they will do that to the United States.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And they will do it to the Germans, they will do it to the British, they will do it to the Spanish. They are doing. The austerity here is as bad as it is in the United States.
Well, talking about the United States and not talking about independent production, when all of these small farms, the independent farms, were taken over, as they have been in the last 30 years, you have a lot of corporate farms, and you have the monopolization of the food. Well, it's in very few hands. That is why it's imperative that people learn to garden themselves. even as you mentioned the Ukraine, there were a lot of independent farmers in the Ukraine. And Stalin came in and he tried to collectivize them, as they have here. They've collectivized them here. Something that that Stalin could not do in Ukraine. But here they've been able to do it because, well, first of all, the farmers here had such heavy interest. They would go and borrow money from the bank to plant their crop, and then they'd have to, you know, the interest fees and everything. They, by the time they brought their harvest in, they would have just enough to eat, and it would just be the same kind of situation the next year. So when the corporations came in and said, oh, let us buy up your farm, a lot of people did that. And so you have a lot of corporate farms here. You don't have the independent farmers that we used to have, who were actually didn't need a middleman. They would take their cows to market. You had a situation in Colorado, which I covered in several articles back in 2005, where the government, the military specifically, was going into Colorado, particularly southeastern Colorado, and saying, oh, gosh, we want to buy your farm because we need to turn this land over to the military. And, of course, they didn't really need to turn the land over to the military. They were trying to get rid of the independent rancher. There were, I mean, just some bizarre things that happened. Like in the winter of 2005-2006, you had record snowfall, absolutely record snowfall, where 10,000 head of cattle actually froze to death and stuff. I mean, just weird stuff that was going on. And you had a very, very high suicide rate among the ranchers in Colorado. Now, we didn't hear about this on the national news. Because, well, as we said before, the news decides what they're going to focus on, and they have you focus on whatever's going on. They want your focus over here, so they're not going to talk about local things that are happening. You get this national news that really is relative to nothing and to no one, except maybe a couple of people. And you have to ask yourself, okay, what kinds of things, and I know this is going off the track here a bit, but you have to ask yourself, well, what kinds of things were going on during the O.J. Simpson trial? What was really happening during that when everybody's focus was on the O.J. Simpson trial, which they even televised? And then you have, other big things. What was going on during, the Trayvon Martin thing? The media has the power to focus you away from other things that are really, really important. But as far as the farmers in this country, they've been collectivized exactly in the same way that Stalin tried to collectivize the farmers there. Now, there were a few who held out and said, no, we're not going to sell the farm. And they stayed with it. Many of them starved because, well, that was the way it was. But some of them actually lived, and they absolutely refused to be collectivized. But,
For the sake of a pharmaceutical, tell me this. Iodine, I don't know if you call it iodine. I think
iodine?
Mm-hmm. Iodine, yeah. Iodine, can you buy that in the shops in the United States?
You can buy it online.
Okay.
And that's another thing that people have to look at. That's up a very good thing, a very good point, is that where a lot of people are very used to buying a lot of stuff online. All kinds of essential things, and I consider iodine an essential thing. But I buy a lot of stuff online via Amazon. And Amazon, it's a pretty big outfit, and they sell groceries and they sell all kinds of things. So what happens if all of a sudden, the internet goes down and you've been dependent upon buying pharmaceuticals or these kinds of things online. So you really do need to have a stock of the things that you typically use and depend upon, and then learn to grow your own vegetables and the other things. I mean, I have a wonderful friend who has devised a garden that's incredible. I mean, we think that, okay, we plant tomatoes all in a row and we have tomato plants, but this friend of mine, she's very brilliant. She learned to grow hers differently so that she used the ground that she had and planted more than you would ordinarily expect to get from the ground that she used, because she used her head and grew things up in cages. And I mean, these plants, some of them are 6 feet tall, 8, 10 feet tall. So you have to do what you need to do with the ground that you have, and learn to grow things intelligently. Learn to use your space intelligently. I think some of her tomato plants were 14 feet tall.
Wow. But the other thing is medicine, because I think we touched upon it before. This is rather the reason why I mentioned that. You know, when we were youngsters, every bathroom cabinet, every kitchen cabinet had a bottle of iodine, and it was very, very cheap, and you know, it had multiple uses. And a couple of years ago, I hadn't had a need for iodine for many, many years, and I went into an ordinary chemist in Liverpool, in Britain, Beatles, Liverpool, and I asked for a bottle of iodine, and he looked at me with shock, as if I'd asked him for hemlock poison. You know, I didn't like my neighbor sort of thing. And he was horrified, and I said, "Well, we used to be able to buy it. We just went into a shop and we bought it." He couldn't believe it. And his generation had difficulty getting it across them. There was a time when we could have just walked into the grocer's store and bought a bottle of iodine. It was commonplace. It was like toothpaste. It was, you know, like DDT powder. And I found out the reason why. You know, I was suffering from a mouth ulcer, which painful, nasty little thing, several weeks ago, Diana. And the doctor said there's nothing you can do, but you can go into a chemist and you can spend probably about $12 American on buying an absolutely useless paste to put on it. So you're throwing good money after bad. And when it didn't cure itself, I went back to the doctors and I told them about it. And you know, Diana, do you know what he gave me? A prescription for a tiny little bottle of iodine. And
My
that little
goodness.
bottle of iodine was over $20. Now, there is the reason for your pharmaceuticals. They have stopped our homegrown herbal medicines. They have captured it all and made us dependent upon their medicines, which are 100 times more expensive than our previous generations used to charge.
And they're chemicals, and they're bad for you. So you've brought up another thing. Every person, every family needs to be able to take care of themselves. They need to be able to take care of their health needs and have a stock, their own apothecary, where they have, well, first of all, you need to educate yourself on what you need to have. And there are all kinds of little booklets where a particular, okay, for instance, turmeric. Turmeric is wonderful for inflammation throughout your body. If you take and you should have a little capsule maker. I have two. I have where I can make my own capsules, and I can buy organic turmeric, and I can make my own capsules. And if you have, I don't have arthritis, but if you had arthritis or any kind of inflammation, instead of taking medications which have all these horrid side effects, then you take you mix up your own stuff, and you take turmeric. You take a capsule with every meal for any kind of inflammation. I mean, people need to learn to be independent, not just in growing gardens, but in taking care of your health and in taking care of everything. You need to be independent in every
respect. Independent of the pharmaceuticals, I think. And again, you know, when my children were very, very young at the time, it's never a good time to have whooping cough. And they were very, very young, and it's a killer disease. And the health service, the conventional health service, really didn't have any answers to it. And after about 6 weeks of my sons, who were then 10 months and 18 months old, there was only 10 months between them, you can congratulate me later. When they were suffering very badly from the whooping cough, they were hanging on the edge for about 6 weeks, and in desperation, I thought, you're in a situation, Diana, where you will try anything. You're clutching at straws, anything.
Sure.
And so I recommended Trevor Ellis. He was an elderly Welshman, and he was a herbalist. And I went in there, and I had the same sort of lack of confidence as you might if you went to a witch doctor, but try anything. And his expression was more or less, why didn't you come and see me sooner? He gave them some medicine, and I tell you, it was like the laying on of the hands. Those kids didn't cough from that night onwards. They had the first good night's sleep, the both of them. Now, they were far too young. You know, I know that they talk about the placebo effect. Well, they were far too young to understand that sort of thing, 10 months and 18 months old. So it was not a placebo effect. It wasn't the fact that they had been to see the herbalist. It actually cured them. And this was for about an outlay of about $15 or something like that. And he cured them. Again, as a young man, I suffered from mouth ulcers. They can be nasty things. I went to see him, Diana, and again, his attitude was, why didn't you come to see me sooner? He said this, he checked my blood, he tested my blood, sent it off to a laboratory, and he said, I thought so, there's just too much acid in your blood. He said, cut down on all the high acid foods, the citric fruits, the oranges, the lemons, that sort of thing. Cut out pork because it's full of acids, anything to do with pig is full of acids, and cut out tomatoes, he said, which are useless, I'm not so sure about that, and cut out the wine. And he gave me some medicine, and I never suffered from mouth ulcers for years after that, and I still don't, only very rarely, very, very rarely.
Amazing, amazing.
Now, this is an ailment, Diana, this is an ailment that the doctors and the dentists are telling me there is no cure for. So they send you around to a chemist to spend $15 on a medication that they know will not work. They've already told you there is no cure. There is no cure for mouth ulcers. It's a lie. We're spending a fortune going into the chemist. You call them something else, don't you?
The pharmacist, yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, the pharmacist, yes, okay. We go and spend a fortune in the pharmacist buying medicines that we know our common sense tells us will not work. Well, it's making the pharmaceuticals very, very rich when there are ways. So if you can find a good herbalist, use him or her.
Indeed. Absolutely, yes. And there are things that we should keep on hand all the time just to have it. But I think you should also not just have things, but know how to use them. Things to, we were talking about sewing on buttons. Learn how to use what you store and use it on a regular basis, not just wait until something dreadful happens or until you need it. Know what you're doing with whatever it is that you're going to store.
Yep, if he's still around, ask your grandfather. Ask him how he got by, and you'll learn a lot. And he will be very, very pleased to help you, any of that generation. I joke when I say your grandfather. A lot of people don't even have their fathers, unfortunately. But the older people, perhaps there's still plenty of them around, older than we are, and they know how to live off the land. And this is the time for young people, because I think they are going to go through great change, both in Europe and the United States, the Western world. I think they're in for a very, very tough ride We were of a generation born after the war, and it has been the good life for us. We are very, very fortunate. I think being born when I was, just after the war, I was the first generation for several hundred years of young men who had never been obliged to wear a military uniform. Conscription ended.
Wow.
So before then, the chances of you being born a male and not being drafted into the army and sent to India, anywhere where the on the British Empire, was pretty remote.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Yeah. So there were two ways to go. You went into the armed forces or you went into the priesthood. This is the way it was in Ireland. Those times thankfully changed. So anybody who was born at the same time as me, if they went into the armed forces, it was because they wanted to, not because they had to.
Sure.
But anybody older than me, they went into the armed forces and they had no choice about it. There was conscription. You don't have conscription in the United States, do you?
No. I think we have, we don't have the draft. By the way, we do have a caller, which I'll take momentarily. We don't have a draft, but we don't have employment. So a lot of people simply go into the military because there's no employment available for many people. So at least that's the way I see it. Why don't we go ahead and take this caller from the 304 area? Let's see what. 304, you had a question?
Yeah. Yeah, hi, Dan. This is Ken from West Virginia.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. Touch on a couple of things you were talking a while back. You know, I think that what was celebrated so widely, the fall of the Berlin Wall, I think to me was sort of a sense of foreboding because the Berlin Wall was sort of the last barrier between the banking barbarians and the, people's humane existence, I think. So breaking down that wall really was a lot more, had a lot more profound effect than just knocking down a wall. And as far as Ireland, the interesting thing about it is that the potatoes went in one direction and the Irish went in the other. I mean, before the potato was introduced into Europe, I think the Irish subsisted mostly on dairy products, food, milk and cheese and this sort of thing. And then when the potato came and collapsed, then it caused the famine, which sent the Irish in the other direction. So that was kind of a little odd little thing of history, And he was talking about indentured servitude in the United States. And that brings up something really. I grew up in Virginia and studied Virginia history. And, of course, I knew about Jamestown in 1607, the first permanent Virginia settlement in the Americas. And, of course, I knew about indentured servitude. It was part of Virginia history. But I heard somebody say that it had to do maybe after the Civil War, who won the war. But, there's this myth of the Americas that the whole American myth right now is that the first founders were the Pilgrims. And they came in 1620. And there's hard in 1607, just in 2007 would have been the 400th anniversary of. And that anniversary, which should have been a tremendous celebration, hardly went by without even a mention. And it's just like that whole part of American history, and including being a penal colony, is being wiped away. And I remember when they had the millennial celebrations, the 2000, when they had all the fireworks celebrations around the world, and it was Peter Jennings who, you remember Peter Jennings did the news, but he was a Canadian. And he was down in Australia. Of course, that was where the first big celebration happened. And he was, he made a comment about how the Australians were proud of their heritage as a penal colony and this sort of thing. And then he went on to say that, after the Americans had, America achieved independence and it was no longer a place they could send the prisoners. And the reaction from the woman correspondent in New York was she just cried out and shut him down. Like, that's sort of like a taboo that cannot be touched, you know. And I thought that was pretty telling. You know, Americans don't understand how to part of their history at all.
Oh, I agree with you completely.
Yeah, it was a penal colony, wasn't it, for Europe, for Britain at the very beginning. And this is the reality of it. It was a very good comment that you made, Ken.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was transportation to Virginia. That was the penalty, you know. And then, after that, was transportation to Australia, you know. So.
Right.
I believe I just did a bit of research on it, Deanna and Ken, not so long ago, and of the 54 movies made in Hollywood about slavery, only two of them touched upon non-African slavery. The other 52 slavery, and yet in terms of numbers over several hundred years, the Europeans have become slaves much more than the Africans were.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, there was a lot of white slaves.
Yeah, no kidding. Along the coast here, virtually everything is Tarabella and Taramalays, all across the Spanish coastlines, everywhere around Italy, every few kilometers, every few miles, there are forts along the coastline. And these were to stop or to help to spot the marauders coming in from North Africa, the white slaves from Europe. And Europe lost a lot more slaves to Africa than Africa lost to the Europeans. No, nobody knows this.
Wow. That is very...
I say these towers all along the Mediterranean coast, they're not there for the tourists. They were our early warning system, you know, for hundreds of years to stop the North African Arabs coming over. And I often joke, and I pull the legs of my Spanish friends, and I say, this is not Spain, it's northern Morocco. You know, it was most of Spain was under the Moroccan heel for something like 500 or 600 years. But the populations of the coastal towns around Italy are still underpopulated because they lost so many people as slaves to the Berbers and the other North African slaves.
Wow. That is fascinating. I have read about white slavery to this continent, as you mentioned, the indentured servants. And getting back to the potato, there used to be something like 250 different types of potatoes. And then they just started getting rid of some of these varieties so that you only had a couple that they were growing in Ireland at the time that just happened to be vulnerable to the blight that was going around. Had they had all of the variety, that they it might not have been so significant.
No, but then again, it was an artificial famine. I don't
sure.
like the name for famine because of... is something that happens when
sure.
the land is not sufficient to feed the population as we get in the Horn of Africa and places like this. So people don't live in the Gobi Desert or the Sahara Desert because it can't sustain them.
Sure.
If they do try to go there, then they die of hunger. This is natural famine. But what happened in the Ukraine and Ireland and in Germany at the close of the First World War, that was an artificial famine deliberately provoked to reduce the population, just as we're using abortion and all kinds of conception protection now, is this was used to keep the populations down.
Wow. Wow. Kent, did you have some other comments?
Just one briefly. You know, we've seen, of course, you know, we've all seen these pictures of the slave ships, you know, and how they were laid out like in the
oh, terrible,
ships,
yeah.
And we're seeing now these ships coming from crossing the Mediterranean to Italy or Greece or wherever, you know, there's a little Lampedusa, I think there's an island down there they come on to. And these ships are just chock full of people, and they just so much resemble the slave ships of, you know, years gone by. Of course, they, you know, so it's just... the parallel between that just sort of struck me as odd. About that's just you know, the body got thrown overboard, and so you know, there's so much dead weight in the ship. So it just seems to me that's it's, you know, it's the circumstances are different, you know, but nevertheless, it's the parallels. I thought was kind of a.
It's migration, isn't it, Ken? Because again, it doesn't make the news. I think it only made about four lines in the local news here. But several weeks ago, 500 people in one boat was sunk in the Mediterranean Sea on its way. Deliberately rammed and sunk in the Mediterranean. 500 people in one go, just like that.
Oh, really? Yeah, now, who rammed them?
No kidding. But this only made the news because there were 500 who lost their lives on this one refugee ship that was coming across the Mediterranean towards Europe. And but numbers like 40 dead, 20 dead, bodies being washed up. It is widespread across Italy, Spain.
Really?
I think what happened, Deanna, is that they have like a mothership, and they when they get close to the shore, they transform to another ship or something. Anyway,
sure.
the people were complaining about they were too overcrowded in the ship. So the mothership, the smugglers just said, okay, we'll solve that, and they rammed it. Now, that was kind of very brutal. Yeah, I did see that. I watched it.
Gosh.
Yeah, so. Okay, well,
yeah,
that's all I have. And I was,
don't get a lot of it.
Yeah. And that would never make news in the United States, so I got it in, I don't know, some sort of international news or something. So. All right, well, thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you, Kent. Always appreciate your phone calls. My goodness.
Yeah, so where the future takes us is anybody's guess, and all we can do is grit our teeth, hold on tight, and just hope that we all come out at the other end, eh?
Sure. Well, I think that it's there are some bad things happening, and
yep.
And certainly we can't live in la-la land and put on rose-colored glasses and say that, no, things are just wonderful. We do need to look at these things as they're happening, but not in the terms of fear-mongering. And that's what I like about you. Okay, it's good. We can talk about these things, but we're talking about some solutions here. And I think that is really, really important to talk about. Okay, so what can we do?
What can you do? You can get wise. That's the important thing for Americans and Europeans, is there's no excuse anymore for ignorance. I always feel sorry for the people of Europe before the Second World War, is simply because they had to trust their mainstream media. They didn't have any other source of information. So in Britain, they listened to BBC. In Germany, they listened to whatever. The United States, it was in total control. There is no excuse now. We all have access to the internet. And it was an American institution, the name of which escapes me at the moment, but I'm very glad to say that they pioneered a project for international journalism, and they do teach people how to become better informed about world events. And the most priceless piece of information in my book is, don't just listen. Listen if you want to the CBS, the BBC. Do what you want, but don't become totally dependent upon it. Don't just put your finger up in the air when I mention Russia Today or R.I. Novosti, the voice of Russia. Go and read them, and then you will get the other side of the story. You would very much object if you went into a court and only the prosecuting counsel was allowed to defame you, and you are not allowed to have a solicitor to protect you. Why do we allow the CBS, the mainstream media, to form our opinions? Fine, watch them, listen to them, but go to the other side. Go and see what they're saying with the English language media in Russia and get the both points of view, and then make a decision based on balance. This is what this American institution of journalists suggests, and I applaud it greatly.
Exactly. We do have the internet, and it is very useful, only to the extent that people recognize that it is also somewhat controlled, that the forms are somewhat controlled, that information is somewhat controlled, and that there are consensus groups, that there are people have formed a certain consensus about events that have occurred, so that if, for instance, if you have a different opinion about something, that they will try to rein you in. With a lot of events.
Yeah, they try to shut you up.
Yes, they want to shut you up. We do have the alternative media, but you have to say, okay, how alternative is it if they are promoting the same kinds of things that the mainstream media is promoting?
Yeah, go outside the United States. I say to them, I say to Britain, I said, go outside of BBC, leave the Daily Mail at home, don't read the Daily Telegraph, the Times, read them, watch them. Until, you know, ITV, BBC, if you want, but also go and look at the other side. Don't become totally dependent upon it. Otherwise, your intellect will suffer.
Sure. Now, you mentioned Russia Today. And how do we know that Russia Today isn't somehow controlled, just as Al Jazeera out of the Middle East? Because we hope to get a different side, a different opinion. We hope that we can look at the other side. But how do we know who is controlling Russia Today? Is it actually part of the Russian media? Or is it kind of, well, does it have some bias? Does Al Jazeera have some bias? Didn't the U.S. military go in and completely, totally bomb the headquarters of Al Jazeera? But we still have Al Jazeera. So who is actually putting out the information?
Yeah, the voice of Russia is, I've got a screen at the moment. And, of course, what we're talking about bias, we're talking about propaganda. But there is another word for these, and that is opinion. There are some people out there, many people out there, who disagree with my view on history, and they're entitled to disagree with me, but at least listen to me and form your own opinion. So if you want to watch CBS and learn your history of, say, the Second World War or communism from that, absolutely fine, but give me a hearing, because, yes, I am stating an opinion. CBS and NBC, they are stating an opinion. It's not propaganda. It's an opinion. So listen to both sides of the story. Listen to the prosecution. Listen to the defense. And then you make up your mind. Now, they will tell you negative stories. Now, for instance, they will not tell you in the United States, in Britain, that there have been demonstrations of over 1 million people, the elite, for one reason or another. But headline news will be when, I forget the name of them, it doesn't really matter, four or five bare-chested girls demonstrate against Putin in Russia. When they demonstrate in a cathedral, a place of holiness, this gets a headline and they're treated sympathetically. Fine, if that's what you want to believe, good. But go and listen to the story from the Russian point of view, either Voice of Russia or Russia Today or Pravda, which means truth. Go and have a look at the other side. Now, you hear the negative stories about Ukraine. And on the screen in front of me, what we're finding now is, where is the United States and the European Union in this standoff between the separatists, those who don't want the status quo imposed upon them by the United States in the capital city of Kiev? They are opposed to them. The United States and Europe is sending them arms, military equipment, as much as they want. Russia, on the other hand, is sending in aid convoys. So whilst America is sending bullets, Russia is sending into the Ukraine plasters, medicines, food, equipment. to help the population. So whose side are we now? There it is. It is on the television. You can tune in. If you're in the United States or Britain, you can tune in to Russia Today. Make up your own mind.
Sure. Now you use the word opinion. Now, in your books, and I've read them, you're not talking about opinions. You're talking about facts. You're talking about real history. You haven't offered an opinion. You have offered factual history. And there's a big difference when you talk about whether CBS or whether you go to the History Channel or whether you watch a Hollywood movie, they are perpetuating opinions and false history. But your books are talking about facts. So people's opinions are really kind of irrelevant. If you really want to know what happened, you want facts. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you put it very, very well. Now, how many Americans, for instance, know that a lot of the movies that they've been watching on Pathé News and all the rest of it about the German concentration camps, those movies, those concentration camps were film sets in Staten Island in New York. How many people know that? You've got to read an alternative press to discover these sort of things.
Right. And
you're not going to get this on the History Channel.
No. No, of course not. And so you have to, and you said you have to read an alternative press. You have to look at the other side. You have to look at the information, the facts that are available, and draw conclusions based on facts, not on people's opinions of what happened.
Yes, but here again, there are facts in the news media. I'm sure that there are plenty of facts because this is the essence of clever propaganda, is 90% of what you say is true, but the 10% is warped. It is a distortion of what really happened. Or as one famous British literary person put, is the worst lie of all is the half lie, in which they tell you only half the truth. And, for instance, I'll give you a good example of that, if I can go to the period running up to the Second World War. Everybody has had crystal light rammed down their throats, telling them about, in all of the history books in the schools and all the rest of it, about how the Germans just ran amok and started smashing shop windows in, and it depends on which media you're watching, how many Jews died and all the rest of it. They tell you that. What they don't tell you is I contacted Simon Wiesenthal Center in New York years ago, and I said, you said the 93 Jews who died at Crystal Night. I said, send me their names. I'm still waiting for them. There were no names. There were no Jewish deaths on that night at all. But, of course, what they don't tell you is that the German people at the time had suffered for several years poverty, all kinds of problems, because of the Jewish boycott of sanctions, just as America is now applying to the Russia. And what, you know, the last straw on the camel's back was when a Jewish revolutionary shot a very important German diplomat in Paris. And, you know, this just got people so angry. But they don't tell you this. They only tell you half the story. And our history lessons are littered with half stories, which are the worst lies of all.
Exactly. And I covered that in my third book about Kristallnacht and all of that. Well, I covered the Second World War in my third book. But that the issue that you've talked about of the people believing in opinions, and that is what it's stacked up to be, is that I think even in the alternative media, and you've talked about the mainstream media, but in the alternative media, it's almost like people see things as black and white. They think, okay, they believe that there's nothing true in the regular mainstream media. they think, okay, you must discredit absolutely everything that anybody says in the mainstream media. Somebody asked me where I had gotten a fact. They asked me in my chat room, where did you get that? Where did you get that? That information. And I said, I think it was in an article in the New York Times. And they said, well, you see, how can you possibly say that that's a fact if you got it out of the New York Times? Well, because they kind of lump everybody together and they say, well, if that person writes for the New York Times, obviously none of what they're saying is true. There's no critical thinking. People are just go along with what other people have said, and they don't think for themselves. And if somebody says, oh, the mainstream media is just a bunch of liars, you can't believe anything that the mainstream media or the mainstream press says, then that person will not do any critical thinking whatsoever, whatsoever. And
yeah, that's another
thing. So they see things as black and white. And which is ridiculous because, I mean, there are good people. Well, there's good people working in the government, so you can't say, oh, the U.S. government, they're just liars and thieves and corrupt. Well, yes, of course, the top tier are liars and thieves and they're corrupt and whatever. But there's a lot of government officials who are just working along in their compartmentalized field, their little area. And the mainstream media and the alternative media are the same. So opinions, whether you're taking the opinion from some alternative media forum, and they're saying, oh, well, okay, this is all wrong because it came out of the mainstream press. I mean, people just aren't doing any critical thinking. And I just do not get that.
There's a lot of disinformation out there, Deanna, and I have no idea. I can only guess at it. But from my own limited research, I would say that probably 50 or 60% of the images, the photographic images that emerge from World War II are...
Oh, I'm sure you're correct. In fact...
I've seen photographs. It shows two little children, preschool age, dead. And the barbed wire, wrapped around a tree. And I have seen everybody under the sun blamed for that particular atrocity. We know who did it. It was the Banderistas in Ukraine who were zealots at nationalism. They were neither Bolshevik nor National Socialist. They did it, but I've seen those pictures. I have seen pictures of the victims of the Ukrainian famine that occurred in 1927. When I published those, British mainstream media accused me of showing pictures of the victims of Nazi concentration camps. Yet those pictures that I had published had been first published in the Swedish press 6 years before Hitler was even elected. So that's the way they will lie.
Indeed. And I think probably there's more, I hate to say this, but there's more deception in the alternative media, because I think the alternative media, some of which, maybe much of it, was set up as a psyop.
Yes. We do know the government bodies like the CIA, and for all I know, probably the Russians and certainly the Chinese and Iranians and all the rest of them, they do have departments whose job it is to just sow disinformation. So you've got to read your information from a number of sources and, as you suggest, do some critical thinking if it doesn't add up. Again, I'm sorry, I'm using the World War II as an example. But,
you are an expert on that subject. And
yeah, but using it, you know, people used to say to me that if you weren't blonde and blue-eyed, you know, you were going to be gassed. I said, well, hang on, you know, you just got to look at the German government. I don't think I can see a single blue-eyed blonde in the entire German government of about 500 ministers.
Indeed.
Now, people don't question. Another one that I was taught when I was a kid, I said, well, hang on, you know, why were the Jews gassed when I believed that they were gassed? And they said, well, why were the Jews? Oh, I said, because they had longer noses than anybody else. So only when I started critically thinking, I thought, hang on, there's a lot of ordinary Europeans who've got big noses. They're not Jews. They're not Arabs. And, you know, this kind of cheap propaganda, it needs what you suggest, what you prescribe, is critical thinking. Stop and think. Does it make sense?
Indeed. And you talked about about the government setting up actual organizations to perpetuate propaganda. Now, they did that in World War II, in World War One, and in World War II. They did it as early as the Civil War in this country, the so-called Civil War. So they have always had an organization that was devised to perpetuate something that perhaps there's always going to be skeptics. If something happens in the country, an event happens in any country, there is always going to be skeptics who are going to say, wait a minute, I don't think that it happened that way. For instance, let's see, for instance, the Lusitania, okay?
Yep.
That's a perfect example, and one that you're very familiar with. Or any of the events that occurred prior to World War II, that we can say, well, now, wait a minute, that I don't believe that that happened the way that the government portrayed it as. There's always going to be someone that's going to be doing some critical thinking. And so, obviously, the government is going to devise a place where critical thinkers can say, or can revert to. And they're going to have that place infiltrated with people that can answer some questions and say, yes, well, that critical, okay, critical thinkers, come this way and let us feed you what we want you to believe. Well, in every big event, they are going to have people who are going to critically think about, well, I don't believe that.
Yep.
And those critical thinkers are going to want to concentrate and get together and talk about this.
I think you're absolutely right. People have got to realize the level of control. You know, I can quote two former directors of the CIA. One may be familiar to you, CIA Director William Colby, who said quite correctly before he mysteriously died, the CIA owns everything, everyone of any significance in the major media.
Yes, he did say
that. He died
that.
Not long after that. And
yes,
before him, in 1981, William Casey, the director of the CIA, quoted from an internal staff meeting notes in 1981, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false."
Right.
Now, this is from the horse's mouth.
Indeed.
This is an admission of guilt that the CIA, one of its departments, is there for no other reason but to make sure that a lot of the press releases that are going into America's mainstream media are their approved propaganda. And so people are reading not what they think is news, but it is CIA propaganda. They don't like it when it happened in the Soviet Union. Why do they like it when it happens in the United States?
Yeah, because they don't recognize it. You know, I let me backtrack a bit. There, people question things. They may question things after an event, and they need a place to go to get answers, thinking that, okay, if the mainstream media does not provide answers, then the alternative media might provide answers, and whatever answers they might acquire in the alternative media, if they don't critically think about them, they will accept the information and say, oh, okay, this is different than the alternative. This is different than the mainstream. Okay, so this must be the answer, and they're not going to think about, they're not going to critically think about the answer, but because it's an alternative opinion, they will accept it as truth. It's a false choice.
No, you listen to both sides of the story. You do exactly the same as you would do in any court of law. You listen to the prosecutor lay out his case against the defendant standing in the dock, and then you listen to the defendant's defense, and you listen to the reasons, and then you, as a member of the jury, you make up your own decision with which of them is telling the truth. And once you've done that, then you have liberated your thought process.
Sure. And you have to base your truth on facts?
Yeah, but the information is there. And sure, the advice, strangely, is out there. You know, I've got a couple of quotations. Thomas Sowell, I don't know whether he's an American or British. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I think he's American.
Okay, if people in the media cannot decide whether they're in the business of reporting news or manufacturing propaganda, it is all the more important that the public understand the difference between the two and choose their news sources accordingly. So this is Thomas Sowell, who is suggesting what we are suggesting. Look at the different opinions, look at the defense, look at the prosecution, make up your own mind. And we do have to make up our own mind, because if we don't make up our own mind, Deanna, then they will make up our minds for us. And Peter Hitchens is a very, very well-known columnist in Britain. He says, is there any point in public debate in a society where hardly anyone has been taught how to think, while millions of people have been taught what to think?
Right.
It's bang on, isn't it? So there is no excuse for ignorance these days, even although they're isolated, and although they're at the minority at the moment, listen to these people. These are the people, Peter Hitchens, Thomas Sowell, the former directors of the CIA. These are the people at the heart of the conspiracies by the government elites. And, they're worth listening to.
Certainly. And often in any kind of a situation, there are false choices because Lenin said it best. He said, we are going to control sides of any issue so that we may control the results. So he said, literally, we're going to control the opposition. In other words, you present two false choices, and they're going to win in both cases. Correct?
Yeah, they are going to win. It was John Lovett, and he was Barack Obama's, the U.S. president's former speechwriter. And it was him in the corners of the culture of shut up, where views that do not conform to Washington and CIA propaganda are silenced by often misplaced moral outrage, the finger-pointing, the sanctimonious posturing, if somebody should suggest I'm doing what you're doing now. And this is why the likes of you and your wonderful blog radio are being silenced, because you are breaking free and you are defying the culture of what he described, the culture of shut up. You're not shutting up. They don't like it.
Right. Well, people, if you can't shut somebody up, then you marginalize them. You create this consensus thinking.
You demonize them.
It's easier to control a group than it is to control one person. So you get a group of people who have an opinion about something, and then that group it kind of self-censors. It happens in school, in classes. The person that has a different opinion is certainly not going to raise their hand in a class of students and offer a different view of something if most of the people in that class believe a particular thing. And that is the way our society has been set up, that this collectivized thinking. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, people are agreeing. And here's a news story that you won't get on mainstream media in Britain or in the United States. As a matter of fact, I sent it in as a story not so long ago, and it was the first story in years that actually got the thumbs down from the editor. Because the television advertisers are so powerful that if I was to publish what you have said, he said I would lose a lot of my advertising revenue. So he was being a pragmatist, he was being a realist. But since 2004, just 10 years ago, television audiences have dropped by 50%. They're turning away. The number turning away from mainstream television media is far higher among the young people. So they are losing a vast audience with which they could propagandize a little bit earlier, before 2004. Half the television audience have disappeared, and a lot of them have gone to, as you and I do, and billions of others, they've turned to alternative media. It's scaring the pants off, Deanna.
Okay, but you said earlier that governments create alternative media or other places. So when you say that you go to the alternative media, you may be going to the very thing that I just mentioned, the false opposition, where, as I said, Lenin said, we will control both. In other words, there's an entity that controls the alternative media, and that same entity may control the mainstream media. And so we cannot say, well, everything that you believe, that everything is true in the alternative media, or everything is true in the mainstream media. You cannot be black and white in your thinking. You have to be critical and say, okay, there's probably some truth in the alternative media. There's probably some truth in the mainstream media. I have to think for myself and figure out what is true in either side. It's like choosing between, Fox News and Alex Jones. Both are, correct, I can say that. Both are very questionable.
Yep. You can only broaden your choice. I'm a great fan of Facebook, and I resent the fact that there is no alternative Facebook. So if they don't like you, they pull the plug, and there's nothing you can do about it, and you lose a few thousand friends. But they even admit it. Now, Matthew Parris may not be a name that means much to Americans, but this is the Columnist of the Year awarded on the British Press Award. This is the Oscar of journalism. And here is what he says, Deanna. Television lies. All television lies. It lies persistently, instinctively, and by habit. Everyone in television involved lies. A culture of mendacity surrounds the medium, and those who work there live it, they breathe it, and prosper by it. I know of no area of public life, no, not even politics, more saturated by professional cynicism. If you want a word that takes you to the core of it, I would offer rigged. It is dishonest for the presenter to imply that the pundit in the chair is free to offer an opinion, when the truth is that 50 pundits were telephoned, but only the fellow who was prepared to offer the requisite opinion was invited to the show. And this is the media telling us. And I was quite amused when somebody after this is a soap opera, you know, it's not political or anything like that, but they really did push the boundaries of human decency. And, you know, somebody asked a BBC television producer, said, well, do you get many complaints? You're not going to believe the answer that this BBC television director gave to to the journalist who asked him that question to get to many people complained. You know what he said, Diana? He said, no. He says, because only intelligent people complain and they don't watch television. So there we have it. You know. The television people themselves are saying, yes, we are liars.
I'm
believing it.
This is amazing. There is nothing on TV that when we turn on the TV, and it was amazing. There were naked people, and I said, what is this? And I mean, they had blurred out parts, and I, what is this? I mean, we have cable. There's, I don't know, there's like 100 channels, but there's nothing that we would choose to watch. And Bob, my husband, says, what? There's 100 channels, but there's nothing worth watching on any of them.
I mean, that's why 50% have left, and they tend to be the older generation who are steeped in their ways. They've always we've got friends. I've got no doubt that you've got friends who the first thing they do in the morning, even before they put the kettle on, is they go and switch the television on, and the television is on until they switch everything off at midnight and go to bed.
But there's nothing to watch.
I know.
I mean, there's some sports things that. For people who like sports. But the news is, well, they get the memo in the morning, and whether you're watching ABC, NBC, CBS, any of those things, if you change during the news, you're going to get literally the same coverage on the same irrelevant thing that means nothing to national news. You get the same story of something, I don't know, like Ellen DeGeneres doing something. Who cares? Or who's those? I don't know what their name is. The children of that lawyer that defended O.J. Simpson. What is they're trampish women who want the Kardashians.
Yeah, I've heard of them. I haven't watched television for years.
Who cares about what the Kardashians are doing? What is it nationally that we should care about who they marry or who they go out with or who they got pregnant by last month or whatever? And yet you can go and change the news and you're going to get this stupid stuff that they're covering minor incidences and they're not talking about anything really important. No wonder people aren't complaining.
Didn't the Romans call it bread and circuses?
Yeah. Oh, yes. The Romans, yes.
Yeah, put enough bread in their bellies and give them a few circuses and they can do whatever you want behind their backs.
Exactly. And I believe, okay, I think that sports is like the Roman circus. I wouldn't watch a baseball game or a football game or anything like that. Because it's like, okay, you are watching people work and they're getting paid far too much money for what they're doing. And yet people go to these games by the thousands and they're very politicized. Okay. I think the football games, they start with the Pledge of Allegiance or they start with some music and they're militarized. They talk in military terms. It's their side. They have uniforms and it's one side against the other. And it's very militarized. And these stars, okay, these football stars, they could go out and do whatever they want. And in fact, there was a story that that one of them was a well thing, and he hit a couple of kids in front of a school. But he's not going to get the same sentence as an ordinary citizen who got drugged up and ran over a couple of kids in front of a school, because he's a football star. We can't do this to a football star. I mean, it's bizarre.
Maybe there are too many people who like to be drug addicts. Wasn't it Lennon who said the football was the opium of the masses? And, you know, there are some people, yes.
Yeah.
But you and I are rebels, and hopefully a lot of your listeners are rebels. And perhaps we, although we're the minority, will change things. Sometimes it's helpful when it is that way. It is souls. No, I think it was again Vladimir Lenin who said that if only a handful of people in St. Petersburg had known what we were about to do, we would never have succeeded. The Bolshevik Revolution now happened not because a minority overthrew the government at the time, but because the great majority were watching the Kardashians of the day.
Right. Indeed. And see, we don't call in and complain. We simply don't watch the stuff. But
that's
there are,
right.
we just turn
away. But you know what we have to cope with, and I don't know how we're going to cope with, is we have to realize, Diana, that we're not going to, and it may not be desirable to turn everybody to our way of thinking, as long as they are doped up on the opium of the masses. Then fine, we the minority can make great changes. It's always been minority who have initiated and carried out great changes in society, and I hope that we will bring a better world for everybody.
Indeed. So we're not going to be watching Dancing with the Stars, and we're not going to be complaining. We're going to be doing radio programs and talking about real things. And hopefully real people are listening. And that's terrific. And when things hit the fan, as they say,
yep,
when it all hits the fan, all of a sudden
we're all going to get covered in muck, whether we were part of the revolutionary process, whether we were the protection, or whether we were just the drugged up opium-induced masses. We're all going to get covered in it. So somebody's got to do something to stop it happening.
Absolutely, and we do have to get smart. And certainly, the population has been dumbed down. They have been mesmerized, but television is very mesmerizing. They've been mesmerized, and it's just been an interesting. Well,
yeah.
It's been so interesting talking with you. And we didn't even do any of your poems. My gosh!
No, this is just an excuse to get me on the game.
We just need to do this again because our time is short. We've got 60 seconds. Well, thank you so much, Michael. And let's tell people where they can read your poems, walshpoems.com. The name is Michael Walsh. He is a wonderful author, and I hope that we can talk again soon, and people can go to your website. So thank you so very, very much.
Lovely talking with you, Diana. We'll not make it so long next time. A wonderful entertainment, I hope.
Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye
now. Take care. Bye-bye to our American listeners. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners, and we will talk next week. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been lovely. Thank you.